Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. This week, arrests have been made after a mass shooting in Catawba County. CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings survives a vote of no confidence by the Fraternal Order of Police. Mecklenburg County Commissioners push for civility after crickets are unleashed during their meeting. And there's actually a lot to like in the Charlotte sports world right now. We'll talk about all that and more this morning with our roundtable of esteemed local reporters. From WFAE, we have education reporter James Farrell. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist at Roll Call and host of the Equal Time podcast. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning to you all.
Morning. Morning.
Good morning.
So let's start in Catawba County. A little after midnight Sunday, a dozen people were hurt in a mass shooting at a house party. One man was killed, 58-year-old Sean Patrick Hood of Lenoir. Catawba County Sheriff Donald Brown described a scene of devastation.
It's emotional to everyone involved, but for me as the sheriff, my responsibility is the safety and security of our citizens, and that's what bothers me the most, is when we can't prevent something like this, and all we can do is find the people responsible and hold them accountable.
So, Ben, what do we know about this party, what happened out there, and who's been arrested?
Well, yeah, as of this morning, Eli, the very latest information we have is 8 people have been arrested, all of those arrests happening in just about the last 48 hours. Overnight, 2 more arrested to bring that total to 8, Isaiah Mitchell and Tolan Huff. Huff taken into custody around 1 this morning. Most of those people, most of those suspects are going to be facing a judge later this morning. It appears, based on our reporting here at WCNC Charlotte, that this is based on some sort of beef, some sort of retaliation there in the community. I should say, of those 8 people charged, they are charged on a variety of different things. Some, murder, attempted murder, others for just aiding and abetting, others for actually hosting a party with underage people. So those 8 arrests and 8 charges are very differing in their nature and seriousness. But quick work by the deputies up there in this case. This happened, as you mentioned, Sunday morning, and by the week's end, you have 8 different people arrested.
And there was some outrage about the fact that Garen Killian, the first person arrested, was given the opportunity to make bail. Here's Hickory Police Chief Reed Bayer.
It is beyond frustrating that someone with pending charges for multiple counts of attempted murder is out in the community in the first place. It is unimaginable that this same person can then be charged with additional charges from a separate incident to include attempted murder and could be out in our community tonight.
So he had been given the opportunity to make bail for $200,000. Since then, his bail has been revoked, meaning he'll stay in custody for now. But this is an issue that's been brought up in Mecklenburg County, too, right? Law enforcement officers being upset at lenient bail conditions.
Over and over again, I think every conversation, every that we have on the show, every press conference, you hear about this. And it also, ties into the lack of fund. It is related to, in some ways, the lack of funding also comes into play. But you hear those two things again and again, Eli, in terms of the police having to chase the same people down over and over, which clearly, as we heard from that clip, is exactly what was happening in that circumstance.
Yeah, he was already on bail for awaiting trial in another incident involving a shooting and is picked up in this one. And I think you really heard the frustration there from the police chief.
I think the other, go ahead, Ben, I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, yeah, I mean, what it was 2 months ago. It was the month of April that this happened, and he's accused of shooting into a crowd. So these weren't, liked charges that he was facing from just 2 months ago. And here we are a week into June and a charge in what is something especially serious, and one person's now dead because of it.
And Eric?
I thought it was interesting, Eli, Ben was talking about how quickly A lot of this has been maybe not wrapped up, but we're seeing arrests and a lot of action. You have so many groups working on this. You have the FBI, you have the SBI, you have the Catawba Sheriff's Office, Hickory Police Department. So this is a case that looks like, in the best sense, all of the law enforcement groups working together and pulling together to solve this.
And Ben, I also want to say just real quick that when you look at this and you look at this story, we're all journalists. We all know all too well crime happens in every community, in every neighborhood, all across this country in Charlotte. But it does go against the prototype of you look at this. Walnut Acres seems like a perfectly nice subdivision up in the Hickory area in the Mountain View community. This house seems like a perfectly nice house with a pool in the backyard. It goes against some of the stereotypes we often talk about when it comes to where these types of things usually happen, when we know they can happen anywhere.
Right. And you've got a kind of rural setting, which is really uncommon for a mass shooting like this. Go ahead, Mary.
Yeah, to follow up on what Ben said, you always hear when they talk to neighbors and people in those neighborhoods to say, I'm surprised that it happened here in this neighborhood. And of course, they're insinuating that it happens in those other places. But we know, of course, now that these things happen everywhere. That's always been the case. And that, you know, the people who are accused of doing these things sometimes aren't treated in a way as harshly as others are, the stereotype of who commits these crimes. So in this case, even the police officers are saying, come on now, this guy had a really strong record, and why is he being let out? So it makes you really think about those questions.
And Ben, this is just one of several recent mass shootings in North Carolina, right?
Yeah, that's right. It goes off of what your definition of mass shooting is. The FBI has one definition, the Gun Violence Archive, which is a resource that a lot of news agencies have used in the last 10 years or so, defines it, though, as a mass shooting of four or more people who have been shot or killed. They don't have to be killed, but just shot. And if you go by those standards so far this year, we're 6 months into the year, there have been four mass shootings here in North Carolina under that definition. For even greater context, you go back further than that, in 2024, last year, there were 15 here in the Tar Heel State, 2023, 33, which was, that had been the highest amount we've seen in the past 5 years.
Well, hopefully we're on a trend going the right direction with fewer, but I guess we'll see as we move into the second half of the year. Turning now to Mecklenburg County, where county commissioners passed a $2.5 billion budget this week. This includes funding for Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, new positions at the county library systems and paramedic service, raises for county employees, but it also includes a roughly 2% property tax increase and cuts to nonprofits and other county departments. Before we talk about the budget, though, let's get interrupted briefly, like the commissioners did, by some crickets.
So I think if there are items being passed around with bugs or whatever we got going on, I'd like the officers to please check that out, please.
That's County Commission Chair Mark Jarrell asking officers to look into, see what people were releasing from boxes in the government center during the meeting. And he was not happy when it turned out that, yes, it was bugs.
Just shameful. 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 You can leave. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
And the county said that they appreciate dialogue and participation, but that people need to be in order. Apparently, that does not include the mass release of crickets. So what happened here and why? Ben?
Well, far be it from me to give advice to any sort of protester. I'm just a lowly journalist. But rule number one, I feel like a protest, if you're going to do it, make sure people know what you're protesting, because I think a lot of people walked away from this just scratching their head and thinking, well, what in the world was that about? Not to mention the fact that you had a pretty big week here for commissioners. I mean, as you alluded to, they were juggling a lot already with the budget and hashing out details of that. They had to stop for quite a bit of time, and then they stopped again to bring in the cleaning crew because the crickets were still there and they weren't going anywhere. All for what? I know some people have reported, but it's not even clear what the protesters were actually after.
Yeah, I think they were saying Stop Cop City, which is a reference to the law enforcement training center being built out in Matthews, but I don't think it was extremely clear how the crickets relate to that. Eric.
I just don't want to chirp through this, of course. Sorry, it had to be done. I've been here 100 years. I feel like this is one of the strangest protests I can remember. I mean, it's so painfully ridiculous, and I understand why Commissioner Jarrell is upset, because it disrupts the meeting. They had to stop it. They have to bring in cleaning crews to vacuum up crickets as they're trying to figure out where they are. I mean, just what a mess. And as you say, oh, by the way, there's a $2.5 billion budget being decided. So there are a lot more important things to do than to chase crickets around the government center. But that's exactly what was going on this week.
Yeah, I've been here, I feel like, not 100 years like you, but a lot of years. And it still has the capacity to surprise you sometimes in the government center. Okay.
Yeah. To get back to the budget a little bit, mm-hmm. it's really tough. These nonprofits were saying that at a time when evictions are rising, people are struggling, the economy is having some problems where people are cutting back. So even the folks that kind of make up for some of the government sources with private sources and contributions, they're going to be cutting back as well. So they're really hurting
at
this point.
All right. Yeah, let's turn from the bugs back to the bucks. So let's talk more about what was actually in this budget. And those cuts to nonprofits were a big part of it. But there was good news for CMS. They got their full funding request met. What does that mean for the school system, James?
So it's about a 4% increase compared to what the school district got last year from the county. That's about $28 million in new funding, and it amounts to around $666 million total. And that funding is predominantly going towards pay raises. It funds the 5% increase in the county's local teacher salary supplement, which is a small portion of teachers' overall pay. The base pay is obviously set by the state. It also funds increases for classified staff. That includes bus drivers, custodians, things like that. We know CMS increased the minimum wage for a lot of those workers earlier in this school year. This is a part of a plan to continue to increase pay for those kinds of workers that didn't maybe get in on it in the first time around. And the school board actually started those discussions last night a little bit. And there's also a little bit in there that goes towards refreshing student devices to help make sure that students have all new Chromebooks and things like that, and replacing kind of lost and damaged ones and things like that.
But Commissioner Arthur Griffin, who said he loved the school system, formerly on school board, he was the lone no vote, and he had some choice words about student performance.
These students are not going to be successfully employed, enlisted, or enrolled. And where's the return on investment for our taxpayers?
So what was he saying there, James, and what was his unhappiness?
Yeah, he was, frustrated with, I think, some of the results, some of the data that the school district has presented. Certainly, CMS has made the argument that investing in people will help drive outcomes, investing in qualified teachers, and that pay raise element of that is a big part of that. We've heard a lot of conversation about how to make Mecklenburg County a competitive place for teachers when the cost of living is so high here, and, you know, teacher pay is obviously a huge topic of debate. So I know County Manager Dina DiOrio had said that she recommended the full funding because it was investing so much in salaries and people and things like that.
And other commissioners weren't happy. This was really a hold your nose and vote for it budget for many of them. When we return after the break, we'll talk more about this. But Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell said the state and federal governments are derelict in their duty to fund things like education, and that's raising costs for people down at the county.
A huge problem for us is our state and federal governments. They are both failing us. They are both conspiring to privatize to the point of crippling taxpayers. The county is the bottom of this hierarchy, and your higher property taxes and sales taxes will be the result.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Welcome back to the Friday News Roundup here on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eli Portillo, in for Mike Collins. Joining me on our roundtable of local reporters, we have Mary C. Curtis of Roll Call, Eric Spanberg with the Charlotte Business Journal, Ben Thompson of WCNC-TV, and WFAE's education reporter, James Farrell. So when we left, we were talking about the budget and the county budget, and we heard from Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell, who said the state and federal governments are letting us down and basically pushing the costs for things like education and healthcare down onto local governments. Mary, is that true?
Well, I think she's making an important point because we see, and we're going to talk about this later, with the state voucher program, that so many people are taking advantage of that money. A lot of people who most were already in private schools, and that's seen as a retreat from a commitment to public education. And on the federal level, we've seen all the cuts going to these kinds of programs and to the states for things that they say don't meet their priorities. So I do think she was seeing that this is a problem going forward if you don't get that support on the state and federal level for things like public education and some of these nonprofits that are losing money, that it is going to be pushed down to the county level.
And Ben.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's these nonprofits. They're getting hit by every possible angle right now. They're losing federal grants. They're missing out on state grants. And now when in this county budget, they're impacted so much as well. I know we spoke to the folks who just do amazing work over at Crisis Assistance Ministry. And they say that in the last year, evictions have gone up 37%. Well, if you're a nonprofit like them, in the business of helping these people get evicted. And we see the trends that have been happening since the pandemic here in Charlotte and people being evicted and unable to find affordable housing. You got to have money from somewhere. You got to have money either from the county, you got to have money from the state or federal, or you got to get it from somewhere. And if you don't get it from there, then where are you going to get it?
Yeah.
And people are wondering why you see more homeless and things like that. Well, when the needs go up and the funds go down, and you're not getting these donations from private sources, that's going to be a problem. And you're going to see it manifest in things like the increasing amount of homeless.
Right. And at the same time, Dina DiIorio, the outgoing county manager, was warning the commissioners not to dip further into reserve funds because of possible economic rough waters up ahead. And this budget does include a property tax increase. It'll be about $36 for the median home in Mecklenburg County. Although, of course, that varies based on how much your home is worth. So are we in an era of local tax increases for the foreseeable future, Eric?
Yeah, I think absolutely we are. It's close to a penny this year. It was a penny last year. It was raised by the county. And remember, city government raised by 1.37 cents last year. No tax increase this year. But just, you know, take those. That's three right there. And your fees are always going up, water, stormwater, waste management. And everything that Ben and Mary are saying right here, there is all this financial pressure. And think about this. We're seeing both city and county government, the tax revenue, sales tax revenue, is coming in lower than anticipated. And I heard Dina DiIorio in a Center City Partners board meeting a couple weeks ago say, during a discussion of office properties, look out for 2027. There's a revaluation. We all know that those buildings are not worth what they once were. That means less property tax revenue. So you're seeing a lot of financial pressure now, and you're looking at more of it ahead in the next couple of years.
Right. And if that commercial tax base shrinks, the residential tax base gets soaked a bit more to make up for it.
Absolutely.
So, this week marked another setback for a big development that was supposed to reshape a chunk of Uptown. Brooklyn Village has been in the works for years. Eric, you mentioned being here for 100 years. Brooklyn Village has been in the works since I was a wee little development reporter at the Charlotte Observer. It's been 9 years since Mecklenburg County picked the Peebles Corporation to redevelop that site. What's taking so long, and what is the latest setback, Eric?
Yeah, I think this started with Lord Cornwallis and was picked up, as you say, 9 years ago. This is the Brooklyn neighborhood that we, many of us know, was raised through what was euphemistically and errantly called urban renewal back in the 1960s. And really nothing has gone right with this private-public partnership. Since it was formed, there have been constant delays. Steve Harrison from WFAE reporting this week that the developer asked for a delay because of asbestos discovered in a building that is contractually obligated to be knocked down at the end of July. We'll see what the county has to say about that. And then he also reported that a shift to affordable housing that the developer had suggested has now run aground because first the city denied a request for some funding, and then the developer rescinded the request. So that sets everything back again. And I think what we're hearing, at least not publicly, but, you know, sort of quasi publicly, is a lot of frustration out of the government center, because Mecklenburg County and commissioners know that this thing is a mess and they really don't see a way out of it, at least at the moment.
Yeah, and the Peebles Corporation, the developer here, they also had a similar project in Durham, redeveloping the old downtown police station site there. And just yesterday, the Durham City Council voted to end ties and cut off that project and basically move on, try to find another developer for similar reasons. So where is all this heading if we're not heading towards actual construction?
Yeah, you have to wonder if this does in fact come unraveled. Will you see any kind of courtroom battle? First of all, will there be legal ramifications? But then if you move beyond that, assuming that they get beyond that with the settlement or however it gets resolved, maybe it doesn't go to court, then you have to wonder, we just talked about all of the economic pressures, the uncertainty right now. How long is it going to take to put together another prospective deal? And then even if you do that, how long does it take before actual construction begins? So I think this is really bad news for Brooklyn Village and what county leaders hope that it will become, because it doesn't feel like there's a solution or a start date anywhere in sight.
Well, it seems like there is development everywhere, up and down South Boulevard, all through Uptown. Why doesn't the county just put this land on the market and sell it and wash their hands of it? It seems like this public-private partnership has been kind of the holdup here.
Yeah, that's a good question, Eli. I mean, I think a lot of it is incremental. You know, they thought that they would be able to get past this hiccup and then on to the next one. And there's also the element of control. As I mentioned, there is a lot of historical significance and sensitivity, I think. And I don't think that most county leaders want this to simply be a commercial project that is most obvious. They want it to have benefits for people that quite honestly were shoved out in the 60s. And so that takes government involvement a lot of times, but nothing has gone right, or very little has gone right, since they've tried to put something together. I am amazed that this is now 9 years and really they're almost back to zero.
Well, bad news for the county this week, but someone who got positive news was CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings. He survived a vote of no confidence from the Fraternal Order of Police. This comes after a tumultuous stretch in which Charlotte City Council agreed to pay Jennings a $305,000 settlement over text messages from former City Council member Tariq Bakari to the chief. Bakari said he would get the chief fired, ruin his reputation. This was last year. So do we know why the FOP called this vote? Was it because of the settlement?
That's a good question, Eli. I don't know if it was because of the settlement or just general unhappiness. Remember, they had been frustrated, or at least members had been frustrated with some of the things that had gone on with the chief and the original controversy that sparked all this. With the protective vests, I thought the statement that they issued, they said that there weren't enough votes to validate an outcome. I'm not sure exactly. I don't know internal workings of the Fraternal Order of Police, but I thought that was an interesting way to put it. Of course, this was largely symbolic because, as you mentioned, the chief is retiring in January.
Right. And this is not a binding vote, even if it were to be carried. It wouldn't force the chief out or anything. It's kind of an expression of discontent.
I mean, I think we know how this all ends in a couple of months, but it's notable still because it was the first time the FOP had initiated a no confidence proceeding over a Charlotte Mecklenburg police chief. I mean, it's the first time that's happened. That's notable. And you had about nearly 2,000 members eligible to participate in something like this. So it could very well end up being a sort of a blemish on the record.
Or just another case of Charlotte resembling many big cities that have had these kinds of controversies in the past. I know we're going to talk about all kinds of ways where the world-class city is becoming big city America.
That's right. And with Jennings retiring at the end of the year, is this saga over? Is this in the rearview mirror? Has the last shoe dropped on the Jennings settlement saga of 2025?
Well, you've got Tark Bakhari's moved on, and you've got the chief who will be moving on come January 1st. So at least the two big players are not going to be in the arena anymore.
And Eric,
I think the other thing that will be interesting is when we have more public release of how this was negotiated, why they reached the figures and terms that they did. And as far as I know, unless someone here has heard differently, the state auditor is still investigating this. So we don't know what that might turn up. So I would think we might hear at least a couple more, maybe smaller steps here in the future.
And also, I think the search for the next police chief will be quite interesting.
That's
will
right.
Will they go for someone inside the department? Outside. Will they make a national search committee? And how much input the police, the rank and file will have into it? It will be quite interesting.
Also, with City Council this week, two challengers have emerged for District 3 Councilmember Tijuana Brown, who is under federal indictment for crimes allegedly committed before she was elected related to COVID relief fraud. Who's coming out against Brown in the primary, and what are their odds in this heavily Democratic district?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting. You have Joy Mayo, who I think is involved with a group called Trees Charlotte. And you have Montravius King, who, among other things, has been a teacher and I think has been in politics a little bit as a legislative assistant. And we have Tijuana Brown, who is an incumbent but a first-term council person. And one of the things that I thought about is remember that when she won, her primary challenger was Warren Turner, who had served four terms on council earlier and left under a big cloud of controversy, was voted out. So it's just interesting that this district now, a couple of times in recent history, has seen some sort of, battle-scarred incumbents. And I think all of us pay attention to politics. Given what's gone on so far, the campaign ads or the campaign opposition to Council Member Brown could get kind of tough. So this will be interesting to see what kind of campaign shapes up here in the primary, which I think is September 9th.
And I think, as Mary mentioned, we might be seeing some big city world class, perennial scandals emerging here. This is the kind of thing that happens a lot in bigger cities.
Has anybody been following the New York mayoral Democratic primary with people screaming at one another and outside forces coming in? I think we have seen a glimpse of our future because we are getting bigger. People are moving in from all over. And these positions are in the spotlight in ways they have not been. And also, Charlotte is perennially interested in its image. So there's a little bit of a clash there. We have an image of a city that gets along, a lot of bipartisanship, not a lot of infighting. We get things done. And this, puts a little blemish on that. So it'll be interesting to see the growing pains of a world-class city.
Yeah, buckle up, Charlotte. Here we come for the world-class. So Ardrey Kell High School has been making waves a lot recently, and unfortunately, mostly for the wrong reasons. Following an alleged hate crime, which we should note investigators said there was not evidence to press charges for, a fight between students, the school system suspended Principal Jamie Brooks without providing any explanation. She then retired, which I believe was effective this week. It's not clear that there's any connection to the recent headlines or what prompted this, but some Ardrey Kell parents were fired up at last night's school board meeting about this suspension.
In the very least, we deserve an apology. At the best, the board needs to review and change its policies regarding communication. And for other families that are out there, watch out, your school could be next. Isn't that right, Randolph Middle?
There is no trust amongst the AK parents with CMS leadership. This silence continues to create stress, anxiety, and unnecessary rumors throughout our community. You see it all over the news. Again, AK in the news.
And that was Carla Stovall, president of the PTSO, and Phil Grimalia and Audrey Kell Parent. So, James, did we get any clarity last night on what happened, what prompted this suspension?
Yeah, we did not. Superintendent Crystal Hill, during her report, did not comment on the comments that were made by families that came to speak out. We did get some comments from the school board members. Board member D. Rankin made a comment that this is a district of integrity and assured that everything was above board. Board member Summer Nunn had said that they, due to legal restrictions, are unable to kind of comment on these personnel issues, which is something that we often hear from public bodies, especially school districts, but that they would reexamine maybe their communications with how they notify parents, which, of course, is what many of those parents who came to speak last night were really upset about, was the fact that a lot of them did not hear about this until it came out in the media and didn't get any official communication from the school district until almost 3 weeks later. That communication did not even mention that Brooks was suspended. It mentioned that she was away from campus. And again, we've also seen this in Randolph Middle School, as that one parent mentioned there. There's been a very similar case going on there where the principal was suspended and we were not given a reason as to why. So we still don't have those answers.
Yeah, and the communication has been kind of a perennial issue at CMS. Crystal Hill said that she would improve that after questions about how students were notified about public safety and threats to schools. Is there any indication of how CMS might actually improve that communication or what they're doing?
Yeah, not at this time. Again, it was really only brought up by the board members as this is something that needs to be looked at. Like you mentioned, Superintendent Hill commented on this earlier this year where there were some security lapses that the district got criticized for not communicating with parents effectively. We were told then that they made some changes to policy and to protocol, and they put out a video saying that they had made those changes. But we have not really heard much about where this could go from here.
Well, straight ahead on the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup, lawmakers in Raleigh aim to make law enforcement work more closely with federal immigration officers, and it might finally be a fun time to follow Charlotte sports, but not the biggest names. That's next on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
And it's the Friday local news roundup here on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eli Portillo, in this morning for Mike Collins. We've got a panel of local reporters, including Mary C. Curtis of Roll Call, Eric Spanberg with the Charlotte Business Journal, Ben Thompson from WCNC-TV, and WFAE education reporter James Farrell. So last week, a conservative activist group called Accuracy in Media released undercover video of a UNC Charlotte administrator talking about carrying on DEI work, which the UNC system has banned, but under different names. That administrator was fired. The same thing happened again at UNC Asheville this week with another video released by Accuracy in Media, another undercover video. UNC Charlotte faculty aren't happy. Here's American Association of University Professors officer and UNC Charlotte Associate Education Professor Dr. Susan Harden speaking to WFAE this week.
We now know that a second employee was fired at UNC Asheville from a video released again by this organization that admits that it's going in hiding and pretending to try to catch people saying things.
So, Mary, what do we know about this group, Accuracy in Media, and about these cases of covert alleged DEI, for lack of a better term?
Well, they call themselves investigative journalists. But as you say, they're undercover. Most journalism organizations, as you know, have ethical rules. I'm getting ready to teach a reporting class of young people in New York. And one thing I teach them is to represent themselves accurately and completely if they're going to interview someone, and certainly not to do undercover work. But it makes great videos for Fox News, and particularly when these folks are Black women, as these people are. We've seen that from the federal level on down, the attacks on diversity, equity, inclusion often really targets people of color, women, people who are disabled. But you know, the North Carolina Board of Governors for the schools have dismantled DEI programs. That's part of their policy. And they basically say, listen, they're against the policy that we have, and so they have to go. And basically, they're saying that we still believe in diversity, although it's been made to seem like some very subversive, terrible thing. But you know, I do believe that this is going to happen all over. And like I say, North Carolina is the state where they have support from the Board of Governors who have said, listen, we've dismantled all those programs. We've done away with them. We don't believe in it. This isn't our policy. So if these people are caught saying it, no matter what accuracy of media does to catch them, they are breaking policy and they have to go. But you can see the American Academy of our American Association of University Professors saying a lot of this is hindering free speech rights. You know, these people really aren't given a chance to say, what did I mean? What am I doing? And we see this, of course, in universities writ large, where we see the federal government going after top universities, many universities such as Harvard, on policies, who they admit, what they say, what they teach, and you're going to have this clash in the future. But I do think the short term is that people who work in these universities in North Carolina are going to be very careful about what they say, even in supposedly private meetings. And that puts a chill on anyone. No matter what side you're on, I'm not sure you would be comfortable knowing that someone has hidden cameras, videos, are making these surreptitious efforts to catch you.
Yeah,
but that's where we are.
Certainly are in a different environment than just a few years ago, where you know, DEI programs were being expanded and publicly celebrated everywhere. Now it's a firing offense to be caught covertly talking about them, which is a pretty stunning 180, even given how used to we've gotten to things just spinning around.
Yeah. And I want to just remind folks that these programs weren't put in to advantage people. They were put in because for so many years, the United States and North Carolina in particular discriminated against people who were disabled, veterans, people of color, women. Of course, our universities weren't even integrated until modern times, 50s and 60s, when it comes to most of our universities. So this isn't something that it's, you know, rewarding people who aren't able, who aren't totally qualified, who aren't overqualified. It's just saying, let's open the pool where we had it closed before and give these folks a chance. But we see these programs being shut down. And even actually, you know, some of the programs of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, it seems they want to go backwards for these programs. So that's just a reminder, North Carolina isn't really doing itself any glory when they are shutting down programs that were only initiated because it had such a terrible record on discriminating against overqualified people that were shut out of institutions that they were paying taxes for, let's face it.
Well, a bill made its way through the NC House this week that would make so-called sanctuary cities liable for crimes committed in their jurisdictions. Would also strengthen the state's relationship with ICE and limit the ways in which universities can defy ICE. The Republican take on this bill is that it's common sense and it'll help keep the state safe. Democrats question who's really being protected and worry about creating more of a culture of fear. So what's in this legislation and what would it do, Mary?
Well, it would deepen the state's relationship with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. We've seen ICE go into different communities, different schools, even you know, outside places of worship to catch people. And then we've seen some community pushback because oftentimes they have masks on, they don't produce warrants. So it would say that, you know, the the state would, and also its sheriffs, its law enforcement officers would cooperate with ICE. Also, a controversial provision is what makes sanctuary cities liable for crimes committed in their jurisdictions. And folks are saying, so if somebody, and it's sort of collective punishment, if an individual commits a crime, they happen to be undocumented, then the whole jurisdiction would be responsible for that. And also it would restrict the universities defying ICE. So, you know, there are two different bills, the House and Senate. They have to, you know, of course, get together. But as of now, it's been passed.
Well, it's something else to keep our eye on as the legislature maybe hurdles toward a close at the end of this month. Although, given how long budget negotiations can take in that proverbial smoke-filled room, we'll see when they actually end the session and how long that actually takes. So this week, we got some more data on how many opportunity scholarships for private school vouchers have been given out to pay private school tuition, how much the state is spending on those. James, what did we learn?
Yeah, so the big takeaway was that we learned that, at least from the data that we have, which DPI has admitted is not perfect, a vast majority of the people who have gotten opportunity scholarships this year likely already attended private school. So this, of course, kind of undercuts the argument that this funding would help people maybe make that switch from public to private by giving them a little extra funding to help them afford private schools. It was actually around 6,700 students that they identified out of more than 80,000 that had previously attended public school before getting this money. So, yeah, that's kind of the big takeaway from that report. We also learned that the state had saved around $10 million or so from those students. That's why this report was produced to begin with, was to identify savings from students who were getting opportunity scholarships as opposed to the state investing in public schools per student. State law requires that money has to be reinvested back into public schools. But yeah, overall, the big takeaway was that most of these students appear to be students who were already attending private schools.
And how much funding, how many vouchers are we seeing in Mecklenburg County specifically, and how does that stack up to the year before?
Yeah, so Mecklenburg County has seen a pretty big explosion in funding since the voucher program was expanded. It's close to $40 million in funding was dispersed here to around 7,800 students. The $40 million number is around three times almost what it was last year, and the 7,800 is almost four times the number of students that were getting scholarships last year. So we've seen a big expansion of this program. Mecklenburg County had the second highest numbers in the state behind only Wake County. And, you know, there was this latest report from the state didn't break down income tiers or anything like that. But back in the spring in March, the state did reveal a report that showed, I think it was roughly 40% were coming from the top two income tiers that previously would not have been eligible to get these vouchers before the expansion. And in Mecklenburg and in Wake County, a majority of recipients were in those two income tiers as well. So certainly when we look at the expansion of this program and the expansion to all incomes, and we look at how those numbers have expanded in Mecklenburg County, presumably a lot of those people are people who were already sending their kids to private school or who were coming from those two higher income tiers.
And the state superintendent, Mo Green, and other Democratic officials have consistently said this is taking money away from public schools. I thought it was interesting that the state highlighted that they say they've spent $10 million less by giving these kids vouchers than they would have spent if they stayed in public schools. So that's kind of one thing to keep an eye on and see what they say with that. But it's kind of hard to track how many kids are actually leaving public school and going to private school. Here's Rob Dietrich with the Department of Public Instruction. He pointed to problems with the data collection.
It would be extremely helpful if the NCSEAA started using the unique identifier system so that we could more properly identify who these students are when they come to us.
So, James, what's he saying there?
Yeah, basically, in the public school system, they have a unique identifier system where each student has an identification number. The NCSEAA, which administers the opportunity scholarships, does not use that same number. So there was a lot of work that had to go into tracking these students to see if they were coming from public school and going into the private school system with one of these vouchers. It seems that NCSEAA, at least according to Dietrich, as he stated in that meeting, seems open to using some sort of UID system that would help better track these numbers. I think it's also worth noting, in addition to that caveat that the data may not be perfect, that the Opportunity Scholarship Program was expanded a little late in the year. So we could see more people that are making that jump from public to private that just didn't get the opportunity to. So we'll have to see. Next school year will be the first full school year where we can see the full impact of that. So there's still a lot to be seen. There's still a lot of questions about how accurate the data is, but we do know it's accurate enough to at least make the assumption that many of these people who are getting these scholarships were already sending their kids to private schools.
And that's how you know James has truly settled into the education beat, because he's throwing around acronyms with no problem that I can't keep straight with. NCSEEAs and UIDs, that is the mark of an education reporter. So the NASCAR Hall of Fame is up for another round of renovations. Here's NASCAR Hall of Fame director Winston Kelly discussing the goals at a Charlotte City Council committee meeting this week.
The main two things that we're looking at is the dedicated education space and additional event space, which is triggered by moving the gear shop out, relocating the cafe, and the enhanced security features at the entrance.
So this project is estimated to cost about $25 million. Roughly a little more than half of that would go to actual construction. Some of the rest would go to design and consultancy work around that and programming. What do we know about what's in these plans, and where will the money come from?
The money will come from the dedicated tax on hotel rooms that is 2% that was passed to build the Hall of Fame and the Convention Center ballroom that's part of that complex, and also an attached parking deck. The way the tax is structured, the money that it generates can only be spent to repay the construction debt for maintenance and for improvements at those facilities I just mentioned. So it seems pretty likely, based on the reaction from the committee members this week, that they will approve this, in part because they can easily say this is not taking anything away from someone else. And as these things go, Eli, $25 million is a pretty modest amount given what is being spent on arenas and convention centers and those kinds of things. So I think it will probably pass, and pass pretty easily.
I could do some nice things to my house with $25 million. One question I had is, this thing just opened 15 years ago or so. It's already been renovated once. Do we know why it needs more work already? I mean, it seems like a pretty frequent cadence of renovations and overhauls here.
Well, I think part of the pitch is, and you may have picked this up in the comments from Winston Kelly that were played, is they feel like some things just are not in the right places when they started. For example, they want to get the, visit the gift shop on your way out. They want that to be in a more prominent spot. They want the cafe to be more easily accessible for customers. That makes sense. And they're really emphasizing the educational piece, the field trips, the STEM education. And part of that, while it is very beneficial and great for school kids, part of that, I think, also arose from the poor attendance, general public attendance in the early years. You remember they came under a lot of scrutiny because they didn't come anywhere near hitting their projections. And one of the things that they've done is they've retooled to do a lot more on the educational side, and also with receptions for people that are holding conventions and things in Charlotte. So
that's the problem with renovating. When you start, you just start everything. You know, you fix this cabinet, and then you got to fix the counters. And we've all been there, maybe not with $25 million worth, but we get it. So a Charlotte sports team is headed to a championship. I'll say it again. A Charlotte sports team is headed to a championship. The Charlotte Checkers minor league hockey team is going to play for the Calder Cup. Here's the call as the Checkers took a 3-2 lead in Game 4 of the AHL's Eastern Conference Finals to finish up a four-game sweep.
Chips into the neutral zone, goes off of sticks, slow rolls, comes out towards Fowler, rebound, they score! Jesse Puljujärvi! The Checkers take a 3-2 lead, 2:04 left to go here in the third.
So they'll play, I believe, the winner of Abbotsford or Texas in the Calder Cup Finals. Are we a hockey town now?
At least for the next 2 weeks we are, Eli, and we're desperate for some playoff wins, as you said.
Yep.
We'll take it.
Exactly. Yeah. I saw a Checkers jersey for sale in Harris Teeter yesterday, so I guess we are a hockey town now. That does it for the local news roundup. Thanks to our panel, James Farrell from WFAE, Mary C. Curtis of Roll Call, Ben Thompson from WCNC, and Eric Spanberg of the Charlotte Business Journal. I'm Eli Portillo. This is Charlotte Talks. See you Monday.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.